entertainers across the country, around the world, and on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, we've got a bunch of new films that are leading us into summer. They're kind of smaller releases this week, but it's gearing up for the big kickoff of summer next week, which would be Amazing Spider-Man 2. But not yet. Before that, we're going to be talking about Brick Mansions, The Other Woman, The Quiet Ones, and The Machine. There's also going to be some news, the trailer park, some listener feedback, and, of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. Before we get started, though, this is how you get a hold of me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com, on facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, and twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thank you, Ron Burgundy. I'm going to do a bit of a follow-up on last week's story. I kind of rushed through my analysis of the Bryan Singer case, and some people question whether or not I was dismissing the allegations of underage sex and that smarminess that was going on. No, I'm not. My beef is with the questionability of the accuser. The fact that it apparently went on for a long time, yet he was claiming assault, but yet he was flying in planes with them, you know, four-hour flights across the ocean. Bryan Singer's weighed in on this and pointed out at the time he was prepping X-Men, and it was his first huge studio film. He got a lot of note for movies like The Usual Suspects, which kind of really put him on the map. But at the time, it was a new film. It was him as a new director. He did not wield the power then that he does now. He hadn't made like four superhero movies yet. It was his first one. So the question of would he leave pre-production for X-Men to go have this big crazy Hollywood sex party in both California and Hawaii is questionable. Furthermore, there have been additional accusations made, and the same accuser has accused three other big names in Hollywood. This includes TV executive Garth Ancier, Disney TV president David Newman, and Broadway producer Gary Goddard, who also directed the smash hit Masters of the Universe. Here's the problem with this. As this has opened up, the lawyers calling it a massive Hollywood sex ring. To me, it's just sounding like he's getting too big. It's almost like when you get caught in a lie and the lie just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I guess the attempt is to try and hit as many people and try and blow this wide open. But the issue still stands that there's no authority involvement. There's no FBI or LAPD, even though now it's come out that the mother at the time went to the police and went to the FBI, and her problems fell on deaf ears. And here's the thing. It'd be one thing if she went to one organization, but she went to the LAPD, she went to the FBI, and they both dismissed her. They don't dismiss these kind of accusations routinely. And maybe if it was one organization, but if there are two organizations completely separate, one a municipality, the other one a federal group, I really don't think they both would have been like on the take or anything. It just seems like this is almost fantasy in a certain direction if you look at this. And the other problem is once you open it up to two with the three other accused, the idea of an out-of-court settlement becomes a little bit dicier because you now have to get four people to agree to it. And already they're all coming out and denying it. And the reality is how do you, it's going to be word against word. And I mean, this is so bizarre and so weird. I think it's kind of blown out of proportion. And this is why it's sort of cooling off as a story. I think people are like, well, now it's just gotten to a ridiculous level. Bryan Singer claims to have 100 witnesses that'll put him in a different location, even though this guy's saying, well, I have witnesses, and then it's witness against witness, and at that point, you're asking people to remember what happened 15 years ago. It just seems overly blown out of proportion. So I really don't want to talk much more about that. I think that this story has been given enough attention now. There's a couple other stories I do want to mention. These are just real quick. First of all, one of the things is Jurassic World, which is the fourth movie in the Jurassic Park series. It's meant to start a new franchise. It's meant to have an overreaching arc as opposed to sort of the more episodic nature of the first three films, which makes sense because those were made in the 90s and the last one in the 2000s before they really sort of took this you know, Marvel or Lord of the Rings take of trying to make full blown series from the movie standpoint. They're also talking about doing practical effects, which I know warms the hearts of a lot of people. People like me who grew up with practical effects, and the fact that the first Jurassic Park had practical effects, just, I think that's great that they're going back to it, because those are not, that's not a dead art, and not everything can be done with CGI. Next, let's work on the CGI blood, because that's, oh God, it's awful. The next one is there's supposedly real traction being made on this Flash Gordon remake. And I love Flash Gordon, the movie from the 1980s. It's goofy, it's campy, it's bizarre. Here's what worries me about this. You can't just remake a goofy, campy Flash Gordon movie. You'd end up with a movie that didn't do well. So, of course, they're going to want to make it into a series and a franchise. Now, if you go back about 6-7 years ago, they did a TV show, which was terrible, Flash Gordon. It was on the Sci-Fi Channel. Mark my words, they're going to come out and say, we're going to make this a grittier and more realistic version, which is stupid because I don't think anybody cares about a gritty, realistic version of Flash Gordon. They're going to try and make it like The Dark Knight, but it's going to end up being something like Daredevil or Ghost Rider. And then there's Star Wars Episode 7. The only big news on that is they're reporting a budget of around $200 million, which is not a big surprise because this is the Marvel movie franchise. This is Disney saying, look, this movie's going to make at least $400 million worldwide, so let's give it half that, and that's what the budget is. But expect Star Wars 7, regardless of how good it is. You know, it's going to be like The Phantom Menace. It's going to make $1 billion regardless. It's Star Wars 8 and 9 and 10. Those are the ones you got to watch. Now, speaking of some remake news, Mystery Science Theater is supposedly being primed for a reboot. Joel Hodgkins has said that he's thinking about bringing the show back with new hosts and new puppets. I'm really leery about this, and here's why. You already have Riff Trax, and while Joel Hodgkins isn't involved in Riff Trax, he does Cinematic Titanic, and he could do his own Riff Trax version of that if he wanted to franchise that out. But Riff Trax already does riffs of famous movies, and they do it on the cheap because it's they've got a business model that works without having to get rights to these things half the time. I think those are great, and those play into the fans. The problem with the Mystery Science Theater remake is what made it work on TV was that Midwestern sensibility, the fact that there were this low-budget cable show that nobody paid attention to, and it was that nature that made it work. Even if you made it a bigger profile show, and you put somebody like, you know, even a great comedian like Patton Oswalt, it would not work. It wouldn't be the same thing. There's something about that Minnesota nice that works in that series. So, I don't know. I'm leery of an MST remake. With that music, we know we're moving into the trailer park. Let's just hit a couple of them real quick. Not a whole lot to say about them, but a couple of them dropped recently. The first one is Jersey Boys, Clint Eastwood's new movie based on the Broadway hit, opens June 20th.
You want to hear the real story? I'm the one you want to talk to, Tommy DeVito. Wasn't for me, we all would have wound up with a bullet in our head.
Friends like that, you should change your name to Sinatra.
I'm going to be as big as Sinatra.
I would love to introduce you to a new discovery of mine, Frankie Valli. Dream of
wild. I heard them all, but I never heard a voice like Frankie Valli's. I know I need to write for this voice.
First of all, I thought Clint Eastwood was retiring from directing, but apparently he's not. And this looks like it's going to be okay, but I mean, Clint Eastwood has gotten very slow-handed as a director, so I just don't think this is going to have the punch that his earlier films did. And even then, his earlier films weren't exactly lickety-split, blast-em-out kind of movies. Jersey Boys is going to be a moderate hit, and it's going to be good for the fans, but I don't even think it is going to do as well as, say, something like, you know, other big musical remakes like Mamma Mia or Hairspray. The other movie I want to talk about is Lucy, opening August 8th.
It is estimated most human beings only use 10% of their brain's capacity. Imagine if we could access 100%. Yes?
Professor Norman, my name's Lucy. I just read all your research on the human brain. It's a little rudimentary, but you're on the right track.
Thank you.
I have access to 28% of my cerebral capacity.
I can feel every living thing.
What happens when she reaches 100%?
I have no idea.
This one stars Scarlett Johansson as almost a super agent character on her own. She's going to have a great year because she had Under the Skin, she had Winter Soldier. I'm not a big fan of Scarlett Johansson, but this is a year that I'm actually enjoying the movies that she's in. This looks like an interesting movie. This looks like it's out of the box. It looks like it's just got enough independent sensibilities to make it work But it's also going to have the budget that it needs to also make it work. Who knows? This might be good. I have a good feeling out of it. I'm looking forward to it. The August release date worries me a little bit, but I think that's because it's not a Marvel movie, so I think it can work in the August time frame. And that's it on the trailer park. We need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about Brick Mansions and The Machine. Guys of the Movies rolling at you. Continue with the show. We're going to be talking about some movie reviews right now after hitting on some news and some trailers that are going to be possibly anticipated films. I don't know. But I've got plenty of information for you. We've got some fun stuff going on at the very final segment with DVD Roundup and some listener feedback. There's a couple films out. The first one is Brick Mansions. And this is a remake of District 13, a French movie, in which an undercover cop joins forces with a vigilante from a sealed-off district in Detroit to find and defuse a neutron bomb in the projects.
Detective,
there's a situation that demands the best of the best.
Brick Mansions. It's so dangerous, we built a wall around it. No one gets in. Now their leader's got the mayor and half the city hostage.
I say we start the bidding at 30 million.
Think you can handle it?
The handle needs handling. You have no intel inside?
We've got someone who knows Brick Mansions.
The convict is my partner.
I got a plan to get us in.
Now, I mentioned District 13, which film buffs are going to know, and the action film fans are going to be aware of. It was a French movie. It was written by Luc Besson, who did movies like The Professional, and he did the Transporter films. He wrote and produced Taken. The original, the District 13, was made about 10 years ago. It stars David Bell, who is best known for helping sort of invent parkour. If you're not familiar with what parkour is, it's that free running thing where you're running around and you're using obstacles to get around them. And it's, if you've, the opening chase in Casino Royale, the first Daniel Craig James Bond movie, where he's chasing the guy, and I think they're in Jamaica or the Bahamas, the guy's leaping through windows and jumping around things. That's parkour. You'll recognize it if you see it. The other thing that's notable about this is it's one of Paul Walker's last films he shot in completion before he died last Thanksgiving in the car crash. So I think one of the things that's going to help this movie is the fact that there are a lot of Paul Walker fans out there. And at the end of the film, this isn't any sort of spoiler with plot, but they throw a picture of Paul Walker and they dedicate it in loving memory, which is what they always do with a movie. That's one of that the person dies during the post-production process. And in the screening I saw it, a lot of people were cheering and saying, you could tell they were coming from fans of Paul Walker, his work. Now, I never saw District 13 before I saw this movie. After I saw it, I went home. It's on Netflix Instant, so you can check it out. It's in French. Keep in mind, it's in French. You're going to have to deal with subtitles, I know. If I want to read, I'll go get a book. I like to tell people, if they tell me to read a book, I say, if I want to read, I'm going to go watch a foreign movie. So you can check out District 13. There's a huge fan base for this in sort of that Fantastic Fest internet crowd. I'm not a huge fan of the original, and having seen it, I'm like, yeah, it was okay. So I don't think that this movie, like, drops its pants and, you know, does number two all over the original movie. It's a Hollywoodized version of it. And while the last one was the star was clearly David Bell, the star in this movie is clearly Paul Walker. Now, there are certain things that are changed. If you've seen the movie, they're going to be upset because they changed certain things. There's actually some pretty critical elements in the overall story. But basically, it's the same movie. Instead of taking place in France, it takes place in Paris is the original one. It takes place like 4 or 5 years in the 10 years in the future or something. This one takes place in 2018. The story is just downright terrible. I mean, like, stupid dumb. I mean, like, really, really bad. To the point that I took my son to see it. And afterwards, I said to him, I go, you know, why didn't they just do this? And it would have made the entire movie unnecessary. They go out of their way to do things that make no sense. The acting's not very good. The dialogue's pretty bad, but that's not why you see a movie like this. You see a movie like this. This is an action film. This is an action film in April, right before summer. So no one's expecting it to do super big box office. I have to say, I had a lot of fun watching this, because even though they took the parkour and they kept that in there, and so that's really cool to see with David Bell running and jumping over things and doing some things that are pretty amazing. And he's 40. The guy's 40. I mean, he's younger than me, but by like 2 years. That's what makes it work. And they have like action sequences and car chases and things blowing up and gunplay. And it's grittier in some ways than the French film, but at the same time, it also pulls its punches a little bit compared to the French film. But ultimately, they're kind of the same movie. And I've seen some reviewers who are fans of District 13 go bonkers over the fact that, oh, they changed it and they just went to fast cutting. And yeah, they over-edit certain scenes in the movie. But overall, I enjoyed the movie. I thought it was a lot of fun to watch. It had some great action sequences. And that's why you see it. And it like runs a breezy 88 minutes. So you're in and out and you're done. This movie does not take long to see. And it shouldn't, and that's a good thing. So I'm going to actually say Brick Mansions kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Next film I want to talk about is The Machine. An artificial intelligence developer uses his program in a military-grade robot that begins to question its purpose in life.
You make weapons for the government?
No. I make intelligent machines. Open your eyes. It's incredible. It's conscious. Conscious machines are dangerous. This machine has the potential to be so much more than just a soldier. They're afraid of you. They think you're too human.
Now, if you are thinking, I listened to your show last week, and this sounds oddly familiar to Transcendence, you're right. It is kind of cut from the same cloth. It does kind of cover some of the same territory. It's about artificial intelligence. It's, again, one of my favorite kind of movies where these people are trying to do good for the world, and then something happens that can cause real serious problems to the human race. I love those kind of movies. I love that kind of cautionary tale. Where Transcendence was too big of a movie, and it overblew itself, and it tried to do big Hollywood stuff. It was Wally Pfister trying to be Christopher Nolan with The Dark Knight on his first outing. This one was limited by budget. It's by a small company, and the special effects are actually pretty neat in this. If you actually, I've got to give a lot of credit to this digital effects that they use in this, because they use it sparingly, and when they do use it, it looks really good. This thing better contemplates the use of artificial intelligence, what it means for something to be artificially intelligent, what it means to create a mind and to play God, and sort of in that Frankenstein motif that you really don't get with Transcendence. You get that in The Machine. Now, it's not the smartest movie in the world, and it has its problems. It breaks down at a couple points, and there are certain things that don't quite make as much sense as they could, but overall, The Machine is a really slick movie, and it's impressive. It's got some really great writing in it, and the acting's not bad. They have this one of the stars in it, though, the woman who plays the machine. She's also one of the developers, who they sort of give her likeness to. When she shows up, you're thinking, oh, she's just some pretty blonde who got the job because she's cute. And yeah, she looks good, you know, in her body stocking and naked at times when she's the robot. You know, she does a fine job in it. She actually impresses me when she starts off as sort of just a pretty face that was maybe you think, oh, she's sleeping with the director. And then she ends up actually showing up and doing a pretty solid acting performance. If you were disappointed with Transcendence, go seek out The Machine. You can find it on video on demand. And if it's not playing in a local theater, because it's a very small release. But if you have a chance to find it online, take a look at it, watch it. It's a well done movie, a chilling film that actually contemplates the use and existence of artificial intelligence better than anything we saw last week with Transcendence, which I kind of still liked. But overall, I'm going to say The Machine rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
All right. With that, I need to go to a break. And when I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Other Woman and The Quiet Ones.
Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Oppan Gangnam Style.
I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts.
Kevin Carr here with Fat Guys in the Movies, continuing on into the movie review segments. We have four movies this week. We already talked about two of them. The next two are, well, let's just say they may not be the best ones out there. I'm gonna just sort of throw that out there to begin with. We'll see what degree of quality they are as I talk about them coming up. The first one is The Other Woman, and it stars Cameron Diaz, Leslie Mann, and Kate Upton. A wife and two mistresses join together to get revenge on a philandering husband.
I am not ready to compete with women like you.
We got played by the same guy.
He's meeting someone.
He must be cheating on both of us because it's not me.
So what do you want to do?
I want him to feel pain.
We should kick him in the balls.
No, I really like the way your brain works, but I think we're going for something a little bit bigger.
I found this. He's stealing from his partners.
So let's find the money and ruin him.
You put the lawyer, the wife, and the booze together, and we know how to do it just as shady as he does.
Hollywood, can we talk? I want to have your ear, just really quietly. Can we stop trying to make Leslie Mann happen? She was very attractive back 20 years ago when she was making George of the Jungle. And yeah, she had the squeaky voice, but she was just, I mean, she was very attractive in her 20s, and now she's not. I mean, she's still sort of cute, but she's in her 40s, and she's less attractive. The other thing is that she's being cast by Judd Apatow as a wife in, you know, every one of his movies, whether it's Knocked Up, whether it's Funny People, whether it's This is 40, and This is 40 is excruciating. Leslie Mann is a shrill, horrible actor. She's not funny. She doesn't have particularly good timing. All the stuff that she worked in that seemed to work out well in the 90s was mainly because she was hot and young and attractive. Now she's just shrill and annoying and not funny at all. Her comedic timing is terrible. Then you add to the mix, you got Cameron Diaz. And Cameron Diaz, she did happen. She's not happening anymore. She's still okay looking, but boy, you blow her face up to a 20-foot tall screen, and she literally looks like she has golf balls in her face, because I don't believe those are her real cheeks. And what's amazing about this movie is there's a scene in there where Leslie Mann talks about cheek implants to Cameron Diaz, and I'm pretty sure Cameron Diaz has had something done to her cheeks. Her face looks like a kabuki mask at times. She's like attractive, but as you get closer and closer and closer to her, she kind of turns hideous. And then there's Kate Upton, who is beautiful and has huge knockers, but that's it. Kate Upton is known for being a large-breasted female. I mean, how else do you say that? That is her claim to fame, and she's gorgeous, and she's made a lot of money doing it. But she can't act at all. And this film takes these characters, and they're horrible people. Well, except Kate Upton. She's just sort of a bubbly airhead who doesn't have much depth or lines even, which is kind of amazing. But you take Cameron Diaz and Leslie Mann and they put them together and they're trying to do slapstick and it just doesn't work. I went and saw it at a late screening, and there are this group of like three women or girls, they're college girls, kind of a little bit behind me off to the side, a row back. They loved it. They thought it was hilarious. Nobody else did. I'm assuming they were drunk because it was a college campus where I saw this film. So it's, do you remember that movie, John Tucker Must Die, that came out? Oh gosh. It was probably about 7 or 8 years ago now. And it had Jesse Metcalf in it and Sophia Bush and, with the girl from Pitch Perfect. This is basically a rehash of that, where you've got this guy who's got multiple girlfriends, multiple relationships, and then the women band together and try and destroy him. But it's the most uninspired version of that. The soundtrack is uninspired, using cuts from stuff like Mission Impossible and New York, New York. I mean, it is like the cliche handbook of movie tunes. You know how, you know, you see like a Martin Scorsese film or especially a Quentin Tarantino movie, and he has a great music supervisor who finds some bizarre, weird cuts that you never expected to find somewhere. And he makes a really cool movie out of it. And he doesn't even need to score his films. He just puts a soundtrack of sometimes completely unknown classic songs. This movie uses all the cliched songs. There's no inspiration. It's directed by Nick Cassavetes, who did The Notebook. And Nick Cassavetes is not a very good director. I know people love The Notebook. But Nick Cassavetes is not a good director. He's a schmaltzy. He just does not understand script either. The story makes no sense. The story doesn't work. They keep throwing subplots in there. And I mean, I'm like in the last, we're in, you know, maybe the last 30 minutes in there. They're tossing in a subplot. And I was like, slow. Would you think this is a Pirates of the Caribbean movie? We don't need that many characters and that many subplots. Let's slow it down. This movie is, it is terrible. And it's got Nicki Minaj in it as well. And she basically plays the Kim Kardashian character from Temptations, Confessions of the Marriage Counselor. This movie off the map is terrible. It is awful. So the other woman, it sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Next up, we're going to be talking about The Quiet Ones. In the 70s, a group of researchers try to prove ghosts and spirits are results of a mental illness, which goes well until they discover their subject is truly possessed.
Who here believes in ghosts? Before medicine, people believed that sickness was caused by spirits.
If we can cure one patient, we cure all mankind.
What's wrong with her?
Foster child.
Families would keep her for a bit, then things would happen.
You're not possessed, Jane. You're just unwell.
There's something there with you, isn't there?
What's that? Is it coming from there?
She's here.
I feel really bad about The Quiet Ones because I really wanted to like this for several reasons. I love sort of that 70s throwback film that we've been having. The Conjuring's a great example of that. And even something like House of the Devil, which is several years old, that one's sort of that 70s, 80s throwback film. This one is a Hammer movie, and I love Hammer films. I've watched a lot of the old Dracula and Frankenstein remakes that they did in the 60s and 70s. I love British horror. I love old Amicus movies, which are not very well done, but they're a great fun ride. And this has the look and feel of one of those films. It actually gives an authentic Hammer feel to it. And the first half to two-thirds of the movie is actually pretty good. I mean, there's some creepy moments. There's some interesting things being done with the story. It's not just superbly written, but the beginning of it works out pretty well. The problem is the movie completely and utterly just unravels in the final act. I mean, to the point that it ruins the movie. It has such a great setup. It's sort of like the whole ending with what happens with whether or not this girl is possessed and the ghosts and spirits. That's not what I had a problem with. Kind of where that all went wasn't a problem. The problem was the human characters had no idea how to act in this. They were poorly constructed. They were set up well, but they weren't. They didn't make a whole lot of sense. They just deteriorated. It's like they ran out of ideas or they switched writers somewhere between it or they rewrote the ending. It just didn't work. Now, the other thing it does is it uses some found footage techniques because one of the bits of it is one of the characters is filming a lot of this, documenting it for this experiments they're doing. Now, it's not fully found footage, so that's a relief. It's also shot on film in found footage, so it's sort of like 16mm B-roll. And that way it doesn't look like it's some crappy video camera and some Paranormal Activity ripoff. But there is a point, and of course it's in that third act, there is a point where they sort of start circling the drain with the found footage tropes and cliches and the things that make found footage not work. So it has ambition. It has some really cool elements to it, but it ultimately falls apart. So I have to give The Quiet Ones a kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. And you know, this is interesting. I think this is the first time in a while that every single rating is represented. There was a movie that rocked, a movie that kind of rocked. There's a movie that kind of sucked and a movie that sucked. You have a spectrum of films. You have an entire range of films this week, whether you want to see something that's terrible or if you want to see something that's good. With that, I need to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking another trailer and some listener feedback, box office, and DVDs.
Ah!
two fat guys at the movies, rolling into the final segment here. We've still got a bunch of things to talk about, and we're done reviewing movies, but we're actually going to look ahead to a couple of them here. One of them is something that I wanted to include in the trailer park, but I just simply did not have time in the first segment. So let's drop this one. It's a little bit grittier of a trailer. I'm just going to warn you, it's not the most pleasant thing to listen to, but it's still pretty sanitized. It is for Green Inferno, which is Eli Roth's latest film, opening on September 5th.
You know what this is? You know what they're doing to us?
Help me!
This one made a huge splash. I think it was at Sundance, and people were vomiting and passing out and everything. It's an Eli Roth movie. Of course there is. And it's, if you look at like the red band or the R rating from the MPAA, it's like it involves torture and nudity and drug use. I mean, if it exists, it's in that warning. And, for somebody like me, the ones you need to pity for a movie like Green Inferno are people like me, film critics, who pretty much need to see stuff regardless of what it is. And I have a rule that I cover as much as I possibly can, and you know, whether it's a period piece, intimate romantic comedy, whatever, drama, 3-hour tome, like The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, or if it's a big superhero movie, I'm going to check it out, I'm going to cover it. And that actually works because that gives you a nice mosaic of what the cinema landscape looks like. And so when you see a movie that you just think is kind of eh, there's a lot of people to be like, that sucked, that was the worst movie ever. And I'm like, no, I've seen a lot worse. And you don't see them because you just choose not to. So those are the people you got to worry for Green Inferno, the people who don't want to see it, who have to see it for the job. But ultimately, it's an Eli Roth movie. You should expect torture. The guy doesn't do anything but that. Maybe in 10 years or so, Eli Roth is going to make a film that's just a breezy, light romantic comedy of living in the city. And, you know, but right now, and ever since he came out with Hostel, even Cabin Fever is a gritty, awful, just really disturbing, although I love Cabin Fever, disturbing horror movie. This one, it's inspired by movies like Cannibal Holocaust, which is an Italian film, that one of the video nasties from the 70s and 80s that was banned in countries. Which is, I've seen, and video, and Cannibal Holocaust is like the original Last House on the Left. It's goofy because of the era in which it was made, and there are certain parts of it that are just really out of place, and that's what makes it funny. But there's some pretty horrible things that go on in Cannibal Holocaust, so it's not exactly something you're going to want to go watch, you know, on a first date, unless she's into that sort of thing, and then you probably got bigger problems. But yeah, Green Inferno, it looks like it's going to be disturbing. You go know that going in. I'm expecting plenty of horrible things to happen when this movie comes out. In September, of course, it's going to come out in September. It's not going to get screened. And, it's coming out right after Labor Day, which is one of the worst times ever to release a movie. Let's move on. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We've got a piece of listener feedback. Red State Gabe got to the internet and sent an email. And here is his follow-up to last week. He appreciated the last week's discussion of, did people realize some terrible movies being made were terrible when they were? And actually, I had another listener, Tim from Columbus, point out to me that it was both Elliot Gould and Donald Sutherland told Robert Altman that they thought MASH was not going to be a good movie, and it became a classic and spawned one of the greatest TV shows of all time. So here's Red State Gabe's secondary follow-up. Ever since I started listening to the movie review podcast, How Did This Get Made?, which is a great podcast, by the way. If you haven't listened to that, it is funny. It's by Paul Scheer. He shows up on The League. He's a very funny guy. And with Jason Mizoukas. And they do a great job just tearing apart really bad movies. Red State Gabe continues, I've heard a lot about ADR. Please explain that process and why it's used and if it's still used as heavily as it used to be. That's a good question. If you don't know how movies are made and you don't know the sort of like the back end process, what ADR stands for, it stands for additional dialogue recording. And a lot of movies use this. And what happens is they shoot the movies, they record sound on set most of the time, and then they edit the movie together. And a lot of times they find that either the background, the room tone doesn't match, or there's sound in the background that causes problems. One of the best examples I can think of it is if you've seen the film Seven, when they're finally at the very end, Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt are driving Kevin Spacey's character way out into this middle of this field, and they're having a conversation in the car. In the car, it was bouncing and rumbling. They didn't use blue screen or anything like that, so they were in a real car, and it was making a lot of noise. And so they recorded audio on set, but it just didn't sound good. So they brought all the actors in, and they had them record over. They basically had them dub their lines again. Now, if it's done well, you don't even notice it. There's tons of ADR done in movies that you don't notice. It happens all the time. There's another scene in The Exorcist, the very final scene when the detective and the priest are walking off away from the camera. The sound's terrible. And back then, they didn't have digital filtering to change the sound. So they just re-recorded all that. And then they put it in. They have a thing called looping is another way of calling it. If you ever hear somebody, we looped that line. Sometimes they're doing it because the line's bad or it doesn't work with the edit. Or sometimes they need to change things. In the movie Mallrats, there's a whole story arc that's taken out. When they first meet at the mall, since Kevin Smith didn't know anything about editing, he does these long takes. And Jason Lee says something that makes no sense in the context of the actual film because they've removed the storyline and they had to loop it. And it's a terrible loop. You can actually tell when they do that. So ADR is like, it should be like special effects. You don't notice them. And there's a lot of effects in movies that happen that you really don't realize are effects. And those are the best kind. I mean, yeah, dinosaurs and spaceships are great. But visual effects, if it's done properly, you shouldn't even notice it's there. And that's the way ADR does. So, yeah, movies, I don't know what the percentage of lines that are looped or ADR'd in an average film. But they're all over the place. They do it all the time. And sometimes it's just edited poorly. Sometimes it doesn't match. The sound isn't quite the same. Maybe the actor doesn't deliver it as well. Maybe it sounds a little tinnier. So you get bad looping, and in bad movies, you get worse looping. So that's what ADR is. There you go, Red State Gabe. And he says, thanks so much. Keep up the slamming job. I don't know what that means, but I'll take it. So thank you, Red State Gabe. You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to the box office. Last week, I said Captain America was going to win the box office, and it did, which is kind of cool because it shows that I'm smarter than some people give me credit for. However, the weekend was kind of all over the place. The big surprise for the weekend was Heaven is for Real, which came in second with $22.5 million, and that's after opening on Wednesday. That's a huge number. Part of it is that's a better movie than Son of God was, and it took advantage of the Easter holiday week. Transcendence didn't do well. It was just under $11 million. And Haunted House, thank God, did not do well. It came in under $9 million, but it was cost $4 million to make, so it's ultimately still going to be profitable. Bears did okay, $5 million for just its little, you know, Disney nature release. But Captain America 1 just barely squeaked up above Heaven is for Real. This week, Heaven is for Real could win. If it holds well, which it may not also, it may have just lost all its steam in Easter week, but if Heaven is for Real stays, it could win, but I still think The Other Woman is going to win. I'm going to say $18 million, even though it's not a reflection on whether I like the movie or not. I'm just saying that there's really no movie out right now for the female audience, and that seems to be primed for that. It's going to be an advantage to that movie. Whereas Heaven is for Real is still competing with God's Not Dead and Son of God and Noah and all these other biblical movies that are swirling around. When you hear that, we all know what that means. It's time for the world-famous DVD Roundup. All right, there's not much on DVDs today. And for some reason, it's a weird week. It's an off week. Next week, there's going to be plenty. But right now, I'm just going to focus on my spotlight, which is American Movie. If you've never seen American Movie, it is a film about a guy from Wisconsin who is trying to make a movie back in the mid to late 90s. And it's an absolute disaster. And if you've ever worked in independent films, it's exactly how independent films work. You got one guy's passion that is driving the entire thing. You usually have one or two friends, and he only has one friend who is always there to help out. But it's just the struggle to get an independent filmmaker. And it's not even a good film he's making. It's kind of a terrible movie. But the fact that he makes it on film because it was done in the 90s before you really could do it feasibly on digital video. If you've never seen an American Movie, it's a heartbreaking, beautiful, wonderful movie that talks to the audience about independent film, and it's made from the heartland, it's made from the heart. So if you haven't seen that, check that out. Now, on the regular DVDs, there's really not a whole lot. There's a couple library titles I kind of want to point out. You've got Get Carter. Both versions are getting Blu-ray releases. Whether you're going through the studly Michael Caine version from the 70s or if you're going through the Dark Times with Sylvester Stallone film from the early 2000s, you've got both films on Blu-ray. You also have William Friedkin's Sorcerer, which is a classic movie that he made prior to The Exorcist. And they also have Conspiracy Theory, Richard Donner's big budget movie with Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts. It's an okay movie. It's not Donner's best or any of them, any of their best, but it's worth checking out. Finally, The Stinker's Exit Wounds, because it's Steven Seagal when he's on his way down, and it's not pretty. Next week, we're going to be talking about The Amazing Spider-Man 2, The Amazing Protector 2, and Jodorowsky's Amazing Doom. We'll see you guys next week. Have a fat time at the movies.